today. Hanukkah is all about Hodah, and really this whole series of shiurim was a thank you note to Dr. Nechama Leibovitz, because she really set the tone for so many women's learning, for so much Torah learning in general, for how we learn Torah. We look at the Pshat, we look at the Mefarshim, we look at the Midrashim. We really try to integrate this approach, and she really was a master. And not only was she a master of it, but she really taught it to the masses through her classes that she gave publicly, also through the sheets, the Gilyonot, that she sent out. And as a result, even before the internet age, she was really spreading her Torah beyond the people who were in her classroom, and not only through Sfarim that she wrote, but through these sheets that she would send out every week. So really she had this impact beyond her circle, and that is really very unusual, and she really set the tone that, oh, women's learning is important, women can learn, and women can be professionals in this area and also influence and impact others. So Nechama Leibovitz really was someone very unique and had an amazing influence. Now, of course, people were teaching before her, but the way she taught teachers, the way she put out her Gilyonot, the way she also gave public shiurim, really set the tone, the idea that we're sitting here today and learning together and a woman is giving a shiur is very much impacted by Nechama Leibovitz. So we really owe her a debt of gratitude. And even though I usually, as I said in my first class, usually teach my own Torah, but I was really inspired by Nechama Leibovitz and what she stood for and her Iunim that she wrote and the people that she influenced, including my father and mother. And I feel that it's important for us to remember the early greats and not to forget them, because they really played such a big role in where we are today. So again, ending on Hanukkah is very appropriate, because really Shevach Vodah is so important. We said Hallel this morning, we say Hanerot Halalu, and we mentioned the Milchamot, but also the Nisim that happened when we light the Chanukiah, and everything that we do, and we say Ala Nisim. So all this integrates very well for our last send-off today. First we'll do our Iyun, and then we'll do a summarizing overview of Nechama. What we saw in class over the Iyunim, and the only way to learn Nechama Leibovitz is through her Iyunim and through her works, what we saw are a few very important hallmarks. Number one is that Nechama wants you to see the psukim. What are the psukim saying? The text is very important, but it's not only your view of what you're seeing in the Torah or in Tanakh. It's what are the views of the Mefarshim. What do the Mefarshim say? What do the Midrashim say? And she also quoted many contemporary and also unusual scholars, all who believed in the integrity of the Torah, which means no biblical criticism. She did not touch anyone who did biblical criticism, but she felt that we can really learn from many sources. And what's fascinating is that every different group really took something else from Nechama Leibovitz. In Beis Yaakov and in the yeshivas, the idea of studying Rashi very intensely. What is he saying? Makashe l'Rashi. Learning the Mefarshim, seeing what they have to say. In Nechama's time, she was also speaking to a very Mizrahi community, where a lot of the students were not so interested in Tanakh and Mesorah. And she was really bringing them in, and she wanted to show that it's relevant to your life. It is something that speaks to you, and other people are also speaking about it and making comments about it. So that was a very important element of what Nechama was teaching. So maybe in whatever schools we're teaching, or for our view, some of the sources that she brought in that she felt was necessary for her time period might not be appropriate today in the circles or the audience that we're reaching, but she felt that in her time period that that was very important. She also analyzed the Mefarshim, and as a result, we see she had a lot of students who became scholars, Rashi scholars, Ramban scholars, Radak scholars. A lot of her students then became very entrenched in the scholarly community. Frum. And what she also really expanded was the idea that you could be frum and you could study the Tanakh on many different levels. And that was another area that Nechama really spearheaded. And another area as well is the idea that we're learning the Torah and we want to be inspired. We want to get messages that impact our life. Almost to say that every time you learn Torah, of course you're learning the text. Of course you're learning the Mefarshim and the Midrashim, but it has to have a life lesson. It has to be relevant to your life. It has to impact you. It's not just an intellectual action. And that is something that Nechama also was very successful in changing in the educational community. And that became pretty much the base that everybody was really involved with. It's not just, oh, something separate that you're studying intellectually. It has to really touch your life. It has to have meaning. We saw that in the Iyunim that we did together. Our first Iyun, this is just a good review, so we'll remember the Iyunim that we did together. Our first Iyun was with Sarai, when she gave Hagar to Avraham. And she is doing such an altruistic act, putting herself out there. And yet, Hagar looks down on her, and she got pushback for it. It didn't work out exactly the way that she felt, and that upset her. And it's fascinating that for Nechama, the message of that Iyun, meaning the message, yes, of that Iyun and the material that we did, was very important. If you do an altruistic act and you do something over the top, you have to live with the consequences. It's not like, oh, you're going to do this act and you're expecting everyone to go along and to praise you for it. You have to live with whatever decision you make in life and be responsible for it. So that is classic Nechama. And that was the first Iyun that we did. And it was only classic Mefarshim. She really only does Rashi. She did Radak, Ramban, and built it around those Mefarshim. And then we moved to Sefer Shmot. And we did the Inyan of the Mieldot, who were the midwives. And what did Nechama want to show? Through many different interesting sources, she wanted to show that the Mieldot are really Egyptian. That we have sources to show the Mieldot are Egyptian, and there she used also interesting sources. She used, in addition to the classical sources, which all say it's Shifra and Pua, are Miriam and Yocheved, she went to the more unusual sources. She mentioned Philo, she mentions Josephus, to say that, no, these are Mitriot. These are Egyptian midwives. Now, we do have that within some of the Mefarshim, but it wasn't the classical view, but Nechama felt, because it's ambiguous. We can explain it this way. And also she had a bigger message to teach. When there is crisis and during the time of the Holocaust, what did we expect people to do? We expected people to stand up. We expected there to be the righteous Gentiles. And not that you could stand from the wayside and say, well, these are not my people. I don't care. I'm not responsible. And one of the lessons that Nechama wants to teach is that those midwives felt a certain moral connection, and you have to stand up, and that even the Egyptian midwives stood up for the Hebrew women, for Bnot Yisrael. But then if you think, oh, the Jews get a pass, the next Iyun that we studied is Vayetze Moshe Elechav. What happens when Moshe goes out? He's a man of justice. This is Moshe Rabbeinu we're speaking about. And yet Nechama says, even till the end of his life, he's still responsible for that first act. Vayachet ha-mitzri vayitmeneu b'chol. That he killed the Egyptian without an official court case. Now, that was hard for us, right, to really see that in Moshe, because really Moshe is the man of justice. And she even develops him as the personality of justice. But Nechama wants to teach in the Iyun, and again, against most of the Mefarshim, and we saw how she developed that. Her message with that Iyun was that nobody is above the law. Now, that is a very strong message. On the other hand, she did it in a very non-traditional way, because this is Moshe Rabbeinu we're speaking about. And this is something that is also a big debate about the Iyunim and the teachings of Nechama. On the one hand, she wants to make sure that we can relate to all of the great figures that we have in Tanakh. And the question is, where is the idea of relating to them, and where is the idea of seeing them too much on your level, right? Is there a danger in that? And that really became one of the biggest discussions that we have today in teaching Tanakh. There's the school that says, no, we should teach Tanakh what's called Begova Einayim, your eyes, your level, which means you're looking at all the great individuals in Tanakh on your level. And some people really point to Nechama Leibovitz as really trying to teach that through a lot of Mefarshim, but bringing that to the center of discussion. As opposed to, very strongly, Rashi always wants us to understand, even though Nechama is very much someone who really follows and teaches Rashi very detailed, and a lot of her students became Rashi scholars, and she herself started those discussions, but Rashi very strongly always wants to err on the side and debate and discuss the greats in our legacy as greats. We look up to Avraham, we look up to Yaakov and Yitzchak, and we don't emphasize or discuss their foibles, right? We see them, and they are our Merkava, like the Ramban speaks, even though the Ramban also mentions issues. But still, the bigger picture is this idea of grand respect, seeing them differently, larger than life. And that is one of the big debates that we're still having in our community. I think it's very important to keep respect and a very strong feel of honor code towards our greats in Tanakh, because otherwise we see them too much, right, like us, and don't really see the lessons, even though it's important also to learn lessons. But that's a difficult, road to navigate. But Nechama does respect and has that big respect, but she brings in these big questions. And that is something that Nechama brought into the conversation, in the sense, relate to the people in Tanakh. Don't feel that there's something far away. On the other hand, there's always that danger, right, when you have this close relationship. So it's a very hard line, but she totally influenced the way we want to speak about the Avot and Imahot and learn lessons, and they are individuals and humans as well. And we know very much that Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch also struggled with this, really trying to show we can't learn lessons if they're perfect, and that's why we don't speak about our Avot and Imahot like the Christians speak about their great, that they have saints. Rav Hirsch says very strongly, we do not have that. The question is, how do you really deal with those issues? But Nechama struggled with those issues and really wanted to show the community and students that we have to think about our greats also as people, and what can we learn from them as well. Last week, we did more of a textual iyun, and Nechama trying to show how Rashi really hit the nail on the head. When Moshe says that he can't go, right? Who am I to go? And he refuses so many times. He's thinking about himself, but he's also wondering about the morality and ethics of Bnei Israel. Are they worthy? And what was the answer? The answer was that Rashi's correct, because the answer Hashem gives, how are they going to be worthy? I'm taking them out of Mitzrayim in order to worship me on Har Sinai and to give the Torah. Which means that what's freedom about? Freedom is about worshiping Hashem. And Nechama ends that iyun beautifully in saying that what's the reason Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim? To be Avdei Hashem, to worship Hashem. So the message in her iyun is that what's life about? Avodat Hashem. So what we see with Nechama is that her ultimate goal was to teach us morality and ethics, but always within the context of Torah and mitzvot, that Avodat Hashem is our ultimate goal. And she felt through individuals, whether they're young students or our age, learning and looking at the words and delving into the material, that's the only way to get inspired. Not by fluffy things that people are telling you and being devoid of the text, but look what the Torah is telling you. Look what the Chachamim are telling you. And in that, she had a huge impact. So again, we're studying Nechama Leibovitz because she has really influenced whether people were in her class or not. They had teachers who were influenced by her. Her shitot became so well known that even if you weren't directly influenced, she really set the stage for education, and Torah education especially. So we're doing our last iyun today together, but really a wonderful tribute to Dr. Nechama Leibovitz. And she hated when you called her Dr. Nechama Leibovitz. She only wanted you to call her Nechama. And on her tombstone, as I said, on our first class, she only wanted the word Morah. So really had to call her HaMorah, Nechama.
Just a quick question. The time friend again may have mentioned it, but what were the years of Hagil Yonot being sent out to everybody?
So her Gil Yonot were like 1945 to the 1960s. Were actually the Gil Yonot. Then the Gil Yonot were put together in books to be these Iyunim. And that took place all the way through the 90s, early 90s, to get all the way to Sefer Dvarim. But her most active involvement was with Sefer Shmot. And that's why we did a big chunk from Sefer Shmot. But her Gil Yonot, again, I'm just going to review so people will remember. She taught the teachers of the Mizrahi school in Yerushalayim.
Could you define Gil Yonot? What is that?
It was the question sheets. Originally, she sent out question sheets. So I'm just going to repeat that for 5 minutes now, which I did in the first class. So in 1930s, she comes to Israel, and she's teaching in the Mizrahi schools, the modern Orthodox schools in Israel. And then they ask her to teach in the Mizrahi teacher seminary. What does it mean, a teacher seminary in those days? High school, right? You were studying in high school in Yerushalayim, in a special school. Why? Because mostly you went to elementary school, you went to middle school, and then you went out to work. You weren't studying, you weren't going to learn in those days because they didn't have so much academics in Israel. Only the upper crust. So you had a few students. What?
After 8th grade, you had to take a bagrut, right?
Even in those days, they just started.
Otherwise, you didn't go to high school.
Right. And if you went to high school, you went more to a trade type of high school. So they had this Mizrahi Women's Teachers Seminary, and that's where Nechama taught. She taught many subjects. And again, it was unusual because they had a woman teaching them. So that already was stage one. Then you had the war starting, World War II. So you didn't have so many students coming in because a lot of the students were either immigrants and those who were in the program aged out. And what happened was those students said, look, we have to go back to our villages, the moshavim, the kibbutzim, and we miss your classes. How are we going to keep up? So she says, okay, I'm going to write these question sheets. So even though she originally just taught women, they would share it with everybody around. And then you had men starting to answer the Gil Yonot. So eventually it started like correspondence school. For years she started writing these Gil Yonot, these question sheets, and everyone started answering them. And that became a fad. And that became like a thing. Oh, did you answer her sheets? Then eventually she started giving public shiurim. And people started coming to shiurim. Then she started teaching in the universities. But in the universities, because she wasn't interested in biblical criticism, she could never teach in the Bible department because they were so snooty about that. So she usually taught in the pedagogy departments. And so she really spent her whole life teaching teachers. Now, many of her students who originally went because they wanted to become teachers then continued in academics. So she really has many teachers. She had individuals going into academics. She had many students who then became principals, like my father, who she would come and evaluate his classes when my father was the principal in Kfar Batya in Ranana in Israel, which was a high school. And he set up an honors high school because originally it was set up as a trade school. All these immigrants coming, of course, we expect them just to go to high school to get a trade, not to learn anything academic. But my mother and a few of her friends said, we want to learn seriously. Betsy Gottsfeld from American Mizrahi Women said, okay, I'm behind it. I'm going to fund it. And that's how my mother and some of her friends really had an academic, high-level education in Kfar Batya. And my father was the head of this program. But we also have Rav Kupperman, who used to go to Nechama Leibovitz classes and was very inspired. And he said very openly that that was one of his biggest inspirations for starting Mechlala. Because, women can learn in depth. Women can learn Tanakh very seriously. Torah Sheba'al Peh. And that really started a whole other branch of serious women's learning. And again, these things all snowballed. So she really had a huge impact. A lot of the young women who would come to learn in Israel for a year were in her classes. A lot of people had her in Machon Gold. She didn't teach in Mechlala because, as I said, she wanted to be a little more expansive in the sources that she brought. And Rav Kupperman said, no, if you're going to teach here, we have to have a limited group of sources of, you know, the kind of people that she would quote. So she never taught in Michlala, but Rav Kupperman was a big fan of Nechama Leibovitz and really was inspired by her work.
She didn't teach only women, because my daughter was in that class, and I went with her, and it was a weird thing, I didn't come to her.
Yes, later in her life, of course, and in college, as we said. She taught in college, she taught men and women.
From America, New York gave her gives credit for sitting
in
class.
Right, Carmi Horowitz ran that program.
To be a Hebrew teacher, then after that she taught Gemara, I did in Vermont.
Yeah, but that's much later, right? In the early years.
90s?
Yeah, that's she died in the end of the 70s, 90s. So that was at the end of her life.
Yeah.
What?
Came
never came to America. She was a very fierce Zionist, and she never came to America. She was very upset with my father that he came to America and didn't teach in Israel. Only much later in her life did she finally say to my father, okay, I heard you teach Ivrit B'Ivrit in Flatbush, so I'm going to forgive you that you left. But she was very, very upset. I took her classes thinking, oh, I'm my father's daughter. I'm going to get a big hello. No. She was very upset that, my father left. So even though the other students who were going back to America, because you're allowed to go back to America if you come from America, but I came from my father, who was from Israel, who came to America. So, I never got, a big, big welcome like I was expecting. Okay, so we're going to do our Iyun for today. That's partially why we're here, but of course, for all these other, tidbits as well. So, Vani Akshet Lev Paro. We have a big theological question. What is the big theological question? 44. That's the Hebrew, and what's the English? 50. Okay, so 44 is the Hebrew, and 50 is the English. As you know, I'm going to follow the Hebrew. So, Vani Akshet Lev Paro. We have a big theological question here. How could Hashem harden Paro's heart and then punish him? Nechama wants to ask that big philosophical question. How can Hashem harden Paro's heart and then punish him? If it's not his free will, you can't be punished. So what we're seeing in many of the Iyunim, Nechama asks a very important question and wants to answer it. So what Nechama brings in, she asks the question right off the bat. And as usual, Nechama is going to bring in Pisukim. She's going to bring the Pisukim from all of the Makot to show us the language. Now, this is not Nechama's original idea. We already see this in the Midrash. We see this in the Ramban. Ramban shows, and the Midrash shows, that for the first five Makot, Paro is hardening his own heart. But by the last Makot, Hashem is hardening his heart. If so, how could he be punished and all the Makot happen and Hashem punish the Mitzrim if Hashem is hardening Paro's heart? It's not free will, so you can't be punished if you're doing something under coercion. And that is the big question. So this is a big theological question that we have. So look at the language in the first five Makot. In the first five Makot, we have Vayechazek lev paro, right? He's hardening his own heart. Vayechazak lev paro, he's hardening his own heart. Vahachbed et libo, he's hardening his own heart. Vayechazak lev paro, his heart is hardened. Meaning no one else is doing it. Also after Arov, Vayachbed paro et libo. After Dever, Vayachbad lev paro. But by Shechin, what do we find? Vayechazek Hashem. I'm on the top of page 111, right? Of page 44. Vayechazek, it's too small, my age already, you know what I mean? I should have blown it up. Vayechazek Hashem et lev paro, velo shama aleihem. So Hashem is hardening Paro's heart. Now, if you heard this big discussion, of course it's in the Ramban, but again, Nechama developed this in such a classical way that her imprint is on everybody who's teaching this, who's following the classic Mefarshim, because she really developed a lot of these classic questions into bigger debates. And after Arbe, ki ani hichbadeti et libo, I hardened Paro's heart. And then before Makat Bechorot, vayechazek Hashem et lev paro. So clearly, the first makot, he's hardening his own heart, but the last makot, he's hardening, Hashem is hardening his heart. But how can he be punished if it's not out of free will, and Hashem is hardening his heart? And also, how can Hashem harden your heart? Doesn't Hashem want everyone to do tshuva? Meaning, what's going on here? So these are big debates. So what Nechama does is, through Torah, not only ask, okay, what do the Mefarshim say? Meaning, what are the big questions? How do we answer these big philosophical questions that come up about free will, about the choices that we make, about being a moral and ethical individual? What does justice mean? So Nechama is saying, okay, we have a big question. Because the Shmot Rabba, so what does she want to show? Already in the Shmot Rabba, we have this big question. And what's the big question? We know that the gates of tshuva are never locked. I'm in the middle of the page. Sha'arei tshuva einam ninalim. And in the Shmot Rabba, we have this question. So she's not saying, oh, I created this question. This is a long question in the Midrash. So another thing that's very important with Nechama is that Nechama brings back Midrash into classical school teachers, regular individuals who are studying. Not just, oh, when the rabbi gave a drasha in shul, he's quoting a medrash. But the idea is, no, midrash really informs the halacha, informs our understanding of learning, and informs how the mefarshim are teaching. So she wants to show, let's go back, the midrash is so amazing. Ki ani chabadti et libo, Amar Rav Yochanan, mikan pitchon pe laminin. The apikorsim could say, oh, I have a question. Lo haita mimenu sheyasu tshuva, which means he didn't have the free will to do tshuva. So how can Hashem punish him? So all the apikorsim are saying God's not fair, right? If God punished Paro, but he didn't have free will, how could he punish him? So God has no justice. It's not fair. One of the biggest events that happened in Jewish history. Who else asks this question? The Ramban also asks this question, and the Ramban shows the different makot. In the beginning, he had free will, and in the end, it says Hashem hardened his heart. So Ramban asks, "Im Hashem hikshat libo, ma pisho?" If Hashem hardened his heart, what's his sin? So we have the classical Mefarshim asking this question. So Nechama doesn't bring their answers yet. She first wants to bring the Shadal and Kasuto, who were more modern scholars, as we mentioned them a few times. Modern scholars. Shadal is from the late 1800s, early 1900s Italy, and Kasuto is the early 20th century in Israel. Both of them big linguists, not classic scholars, classic, you know, Mefarshim, at all, but here she wants to bring their answers to show they're not satisfying, which means a lot of times you'd say, oh, the modern people, they always have the satisfying answers that we can relate to. Here she wants to show, no, it could be the classic Mefarshim that have the answers that really resonate, but she wants to show, look at their attempts, right? They're going to be wrong, but look at their attempts. How are they trying to answer this question? They're doing apologetics, she wants to say. How are they answering this question? So she brings in Shadal and Kasuto, and how are they answering this question? What does it mean Hashem hardened their heart? What does it mean Hashem got involved? Really, they say, who runs the world? Hashem. So anything you do, really, who's in charge? Hashem. So by saying Hashem hardened his heart, it doesn't really mean he took away his free choice, because who runs the world and does everything anyway? God. So Shadal is saying, it's just like language, but really, Hashem runs the world, it's no different. Kasuto also says, yeah, because if you look at the language, really Hashem runs everything. Just sometimes in Tanakh it uses kind of different language, but overall Hashem runs everything. So these are not philosophical questions. So Nechama brings them in, but she says, those are not good answers, because if that was true, from the beginning it should have said Hashem hardened his heart. Obviously, the fact that we start one way and then we continue another way shows there's a transition here. It's not just, oh, you could say Hashem runs everything, so that's why you could use this language interchangeably. No, there's definitely some kind of progression here from one thing to the next. So then she brings in, and again, in these iyunim, right, she's bringing the answers that she wants to reject, and in the end, she's going to bring her answer. Who are the two individuals that she quotes? She quotes Rav Yosef Albo. He wrote Sefer HaIkarim, answered big philosophical questions. Ikare Emuna. He's from 1380 to 1444. He had a few principles, whereas the Rambam before him had 13 principles. Rav Yosef Albo wanted to say, you know, there are a few less and we can highlight them. And then we have Rav Ovadia Sforno during the time of humanism. Now, their answers are, excuse me, I drank right before class, but I need to drink again right now. So what is the answer of Rav Yosef Albo? A very good answer that we understand today psychologically, that Hashem hardens his heart because he is just going to give in, not because he really changed his mind, but the pressure of the makot are so hard that he doesn't have the stamina to say no anymore. Even though he doesn't agree, doesn't believe God is doing this, he's just so in pain, and his people are in pain, that the pressure is getting to him, but he's not admitting that God runs the world. What's the whole idea of the makot? So he'll realize that God runs the world. But he just wants the pain to stop. And we know this from torture, right? Many times if you torture someone, they're going to make confessions. They're going to say things that they don't mean because they're under duress. So Rav Yosef Albo says Hashem hardens his heart because he still didn't learn his lesson. So to get him to the point of learning his lesson and getting to Makat Bechorot, Hashem had to harden his heart because he was giving in. Why? Only because the pressure was so great. So in order for the real lesson of the Makot to be learned, that he really realizes this is Hashem and he's going to let Bnei Israel out wholeheartedly, can only happen if Hashem steps in and hardens his heart, only because he doesn't have the wherewithal to withstand this kind of pressure. And the Ovadia Sforno says something very similar. It's really because of the pressure. It's a false statement. It's a false admission. What's one of the biggest problems we have in the police today when someone is brought in and without a lawyer and under duress, or we're worried about torture? What do we say? The confessions are not really real, because a lot of times you do it just to get out of the pressure, just to get out of the situation. That's the way our minds work. We just want to get out of this situation, and we're willing to do anything, even lie, in order to get out of that position. So that's the view of Rav Yosef Albo and Ovadia Sforno. Also pretty good answers. But Nechama says, but those aren't the answers here. Who is really giving us the real ultimate answer to this issue? And that's going to be the Rambam. So let's go to page 114 in the Hebrew. 114 in the Hebrew. She says, who has the right answer? And what is it in someone who's looking up in the English will tell us, right? What it is in the English. 52. What? Okay, bottom of 52, and then it zoops to the top of 53. It's the Rambam. And what is the view of the Rambam? The Rambam is saying something very profound. And again, this is interesting, because the Rambam didn't write a Perush on the Torah. So what Nechama does many times is she says, in order to understand the Torah, we have to bring in the Rambam. We have to bring in the Ralbag from his philosophical works. We have to bring Rav Yosef Albo, which means we have to bring philosophers as well. And she brought many different philosophers and Balei Machshava into her Iyunim, because they also have a lot to say. So that's also fascinating, which means she really brought in a wide array of sources in order for us to learn. So what is her bringing of the Rambam? She brings in this very important idea. On the one hand, we all have free will. And one of the most important elements of life is that we have free will. And we always have the ability to do tshuva. And tshuva is always going to stop. If we do real tshuva, it's always going to stop any kind of punishments that we have. Because full tshuva is always open to us. And we can do it out of our free will and out of our knowledge. However, the Rambam says, there are certain circumstances where someone sins so much, right? And this is a Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva, that someone will sin so much that what happens? They're getting into a pattern that they can't get out of. And what is this pattern? We had it with Sichon, we had it with Paro, which means you're acting in such a bad way that you're on this track and that Hashem is going to punish you for these actions that you do. And what happens? It seems like... It seems like Hashem is stopping you from doing tshuva. Because Hashem wants to make sure that you're going to get punished, right? So it seems like Hashem is hardening his heart. But what does the Rambam say? No. Kulam chat'u me'atzman, I'm on top of page 115. V'kulam nitchayvu limnoa mehena tshuva. So what does it mean that you sin so much that we can't let you do tshuva? Can Hashem really stop you from doing tshuva? You still have free will. So what is it that you sin in a certain way that you can't do tshuva? So what the Rambam is saying, and again, it's fascinating. Usually what does Nechama do? She quotes a few lines of a parshan. She quotes a few lines, but what do we see here? She's spending a lot of real estate in order to quote the Rambam. So when you have a chance, read the Rambam yourselves. What does the Rambam say? And I'm on the top of page 115. I'm on the third little paragraph. Ela hu me'atzmo umida'ato note le'ezo derech sheyirtzeh. Yeah, thank you. I'm going to use it again in a second. Thank you so much. Mida'ato ume'atzmo note le'ezo derech sheyirtzeh. So on the one hand, what's the Rambam saying? A person has free will. He does whatever he wants. You could do tshuva whenever you want. But sometimes a person sins so much that Hashem wants them to get punished. So which one is it? Do you always have a chance to do tshuva? Or are you sometimes in a position where you're going to be in a situation where you can't do tshuva? So the Rambam says something very profound. And Nechama wants to bring it in this way. That when you sin, sometimes you get to a point of no return. You've done it so many times, you're in a rut. This is the Rambam. You're in a rut. You're in this path. And it's hard for you to stop doing this action. And you need outside help to stop doing this action. And that's where the interface with Hashem is. Because sometimes when we dive into Hashem and we do tshuva, we're not only asking, forgive me for what I did. We're asking Hashem for help to help me stop acting the way that I did. Because sometimes you get into a position, it's so hard to turn back, you need outside help. You yourself don't have enough of the ability to turn back. So the Rambam is saying, what happened with Paro? It's not that Hashem really went in and hardened his heart. Hashem decided, I'm not going to step in to help him go in the other direction. He's really focused in this direction. I'm letting nature take its course. And his heart is being hardened by the path that once someone does something so much, it's hard to turn back. And as a result, when they have no interest in doing tshuva, then they have to be punished for these actions. And usually this is only people who do terribly evil things. For example, if Hitler like got up one morning and said, okay, right, I'm sorry for what I did. Is he really turning back? Is he really changing his mind? And for someone doing that kind of evil, can there be tshuva just by saying it after you did all this? What? So tshuva is a very difficult idea. You did it. So how are you not punished for it? So the Rambam develops this idea, look at the bottom on page 115, that what is tshuva? When we dive into Hashem and we want to do tshuva, and she's spread out these letters so you see, al yigrumuli chata'ai limon'eni mitshuva. Don't let my sins stop me from doing tshuva. Which means, it's very hard to do tshuva, because once you act in a certain way and we're in a certain rut and we do things all the time, to change is so monumental. And for that, you have to ask Hashem for help. What was Paro doing? He's not asking Hashem for help. He's not trying to change his ways. So when it says Hashem hardened his heart, it's like he got himself into this position, says the Rambam, and nature is such that that's what's going to happen. So Rambam ends with a beautiful idea, and this is really what Nechama wants to emphasize. To do good, Hashem is always going to be there to help you. And the Rambam uses these words, Ba'ali Taher, I'm on the bottom of page 115, at the end of the words of the Rambam, Ba'ali Taher Misayinoto. If you want to do the right thing and become Tahor, Hashem helps you. Which means, if you want to do the right thing, Hashem is always there to help you. If you want to do the wrong thing, God lets you do it. Because you could say, Hashem, how come you're not intervening? But that's the nature of the world. Which means once you get into this kind of pattern, that is your free choice, but almost you lose your free choice if you do it all the time. And to get out of it, you have to dive into Hashem. You need outside help, right, in order to go in the right direction. So Nechama wants to really end this iyun. What is free choice? Free choice is something that everyone is given. Everyone's responsible for their actions. Even Paro. Once you go in a certain direction and you just act in this evil way, it's very hard to turn around. And the nature of this world is that you're just going to continue in this path. In order to break that rut, to break that pattern, you have to reach out to Hashem. Paro was not reaching out to Hashem. So Hashem is saying, okay, this is the pattern of the world. Paro is going in this rut. He is determined that he is going to just oppress Bnei Israel, and everything that's happening is not really going to turn him around. Not because he made a new decision. It's one decision that's built on the other. So Nechama wants to emphasize, it isn't that, oh, like Yosef Albo and Ovadia Sforno, that Hashem is stopping him from changing his mind because he wants him to understand that Hashem is really the most powerful individual in this world. Hashem didn't have to add and do anything. According to the Rambam, it's his own actions, piling one on the other on the other. So when he was so stark on the first Makot, and he was angry, and his heart is hardened, he's already in a certain way he can't turn himself back. The only way he would be able to turn around would be by divine intervention. And divine intervention would only come if we saw that Paro would reach out to God and ask Hashem in order to change his future. So what Nechama wants to end with this iyun is that we're always very responsible for our actions. She was very much into this idea of being responsible for your actions and know where your actions are going to lead to. And if you feel that you're in a certain situation, right, to do tshuva, you have to reach out, like the Rambam says, to reach out to Hashem. And Hashem is always, Habali Taher Misayinoto, Hashem is always going to help you to go in the right direction. But if you do bad, Hashem doesn't help you. He just lets you do what you want, but doesn't intervene. And yes, humans have free choice, but we have to realize our partnership with Hashem. So a beautiful end that Nechama wants to teach in the end of this iyun. Now, ha'adam hu abocher. For her, the free choice in the initial part of the journey is very important, as she ends with. And if you harden your heart, then if you turn to Hashem, Hashem is always going to help you. But if you do bad, Hashem doesn't help you, but he lets you, because free choice is such an important element. So this is the way Nechama is dealing with the idea of free choice. So what's fascinating also here is that she also moves a theological debate about free choice and justice, divine justice, into also a psychological and emotional message in order to cope day to day, or with the idea of sin and punishment and evil and good. And this is also a classic iyun by Nechama, where she brings the other opinions first to show you, but in the end, the classic Mefarshim, Rambam, has that answer that really is the secret to free choice and life. Yeah.
So isn't this the concept of Darsha Adam Rotzeli Lachbom, like that's the idea she's talking
right.
about?
Right. No? She brings this idea in another Iyun very strongly. She brings that in the idea that Paro hitches his own chariot. That she wants to show in the end. Yeah, he's so angry that he hitches his own chariot to run after B'nai Israel. One more question, and then I know it's Hanukkah. We have so many things to do.
So to me, this is actually, when it's explained, like the way Nachman explains it, to me it seems very much like Paro very much had this free will. Like, if anything, Hashem was just letting him do what he wanted.
Exactly.
That's what you're choosing to do.
Exactly. So she's going, that's the view of the Rambam, and she says that is, he had free choice the whole time, and he chose to do, and then she brings this other Iyun that he's hitching his own chariot because he's very motivated. You know, and that's a long history that he has.